Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
Welcome to Camo X. No, this is not the president. Not even the State of the Union address. Hi, I'm Brad Young, sitting in this evening at your service from 8 o'clock until 10 o'clock. But tonight was supposed to be the State of the Union address, and it's not here. You know, I mean, the closest thing we have to it is me and Mike Anderson at the controls here. That's the closest thing we have to a State of the Union. But because of that, what I wanted to do is this. This is what occurred to me when the State of the Union address got canceled. We know, and you've probably seen the same documentaries that I've seen, that how much work goes into putting together a State of the Union address. It takes months and months and lots of data. But if you were going to give your own State of the Union address, what would you say? I mean, there certainly is plenty to talk about. It's not like there's a lack of things to discuss. So we're going to open the phone lines up this evening at 314-436-7900 or 1-800-925-1120. And the question for the evening, at least for this hour, is this. If you were giving the State of the Union address, if the telephone rang and it was President Trump saying, hey, look, I need you to fill in for me. I need you to give the speech. Yeah, I had something written here, but, you know, it was written in crayon, so you can't read it. So come up with your own speech. What would it be? So I would like to hear your thoughts on how you would write the State of the Union address. What would you say? What would you highlight? What would be your focus? Would it be snarky? Would it be informative? Would it be like so many other State of the Union addresses that we've seen over the years? Long, boring, and in need of editing? Or would it be sharp, punchy, and funny? And what would you say? And that's what I would like to hear your perspective this evening on Camo X. Again, 314-436-7900 or 1-800-925-1120. Speaking of the State of the Union address, and that's going to be our theme here for a little bit this evening, and you may remember that the President Trump got really kicked out of Congress by Nancy Pelosi when it came to the State of the Union address. He was going to give it. It was supposed to be right now, 8 o'clock, Tuesday evening. And yet he couldn't give it because Nancy Pelosi said, as long as the government's shut down, we're not going to give the State of the Union address. Now, if President Trump would have called me, this is the advice that I would have given him. I would have said, don't cave to Nancy Pelosi. You should go on the road and say, if the Congress doesn't want to hear the State of the Union, then I will take it to the people and let the people hear the State of the Union. And I would have gone to Ohio or Pennsylvania or Wisconsin or Florida, and I would have, or even Michigan, one of these swing states, and I would have given the State of the Union, except I would have called it the State of the People address or something like that, talking directly to the public and bypassing Congress. But that's not what happened. So what happened was, as we all know, just kind of briefly recapping here, previously when you see a show, they bring you up to speed on what happened last week. And that is that there is no State of the Union tonight, but it has been rescheduled. In fact, yesterday, Nancy Pelosi invited President Trump to give and to come to Congress on February 5 to deliver the State of the Union address to the Congress. Now, as the show unfolds this evening, you're going to want to stick around because I want to talk about the history of the State of the Union. I want to get into the details of why the presidents do it and how the way that presidents do it today is far different than the way presidents did the State of the Union address in prior centuries, even in prior decades. So we're going to get into that and go through that history for you. But one of the interesting things is that when President Trump responded to Nancy Pelosi's invitation, here's what he said. "We have a great story to tell and yet great goals to achieve," he said in a letter which was released by the White House. Of course, it was a propaganda. But now the speech has been rescheduled for next Tuesday, February 5. But looming behind all of this is the fact that the government's reopened. Yes, it has. And yet it's only going to be open until February 15, pending some completion of these negotiations for the ever-present border wall issue. So Trump is mulling at this point, declaring, and we're going to get into this more again as the evening unfolds, but he's mulling declaring a national emergency on this issue if a bipartisan congressional committee does not produce a deal that includes what we've heard about so many times, the $5.7 billion in border wall funding. Now, thankfully, and I think you heard this certainly recently on Camo X, Missouri Senator Roy Blunt is on that committee, and they're negotiating. And I think, frankly, that's the best thing that we're going to do, is to have Congress to negotiate this, not the president. And we're going to take a break here, and when we come back, again, I want to hear from you. We've got some folks lined up, but I want to hear from you as to what would be your topics for a State of the Union address. Again, phone lines are open, 314-436-7900 or 800-925-1120. It's Brad Young sitting in this evening in lieu of the president's State of the Union address on Camo X.
St. Louis's news, traffic, and weather. News Radio 1120, KMOX. Depend on it.
Brad Young, back with you on Camo X. Mike Anderson, good choice of music this evening because it is as cold as ice. You know my law firm, Harris Dow Fisher & Young. I play lawyer during the day, and at night I freelance on Camo X Radio. Glad you're with us on this cold evening. And I've been talking about the State of the Union address that wasn't. It will be next week, but it wasn't this evening. So we're going to talk about the State of the Union address and the history and why it's important and how they're written. But before we got into all of that minutia of details, I wanted to hear from you. And so Scott has called in this evening to talk about his ideas for the State of the Union address. Scott, welcome to Camo X.
Thanks for having me. First of all, it's awesome that you're having this conversation tonight, because it's really our conversation, not theirs. That's what makes it the State of the Union, right?
Oh, you're exactly right. It's supposed to be to the people, for the people, and unfortunately so many times it isn't. So that's why I wanted to hear from the people this evening, since our leaders never seem to hear from us. So I thought we could hear from you this evening.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, but I just wanted to remind folks, and I encourage them to educate themselves to it by simply reading the congressional record. But, in December of 1801, Jefferson sort of broke with what was a very, very short-lived tradition of a public address, and had set a written State of the Union to be delivered by his secretary, Meriwether Lewis, to the Congress, rather than delivering it himself. He did it by proxy through Lewis. And there were a lot of raised eyebrows and judgmental commentaries made about his failure to appear before the Congress. But he made a great comment by talking about the fact that the new Congress had opened with good humor, more than he had expected. And he thought by sending it via proxy, that it would eliminate their need to respond with a curt or, just confrontational reply.
Well, and the other thing too, Scott, if I recall my history, the other element that went into that decision by Thomas Jefferson to send it in writing was that he did not want to appear as he was a king or something. His feeling was if he talked and addressed Congress, it would be as if he were the king or above them. And certainly Thomas Jefferson, more than perhaps anyone, uniquely understood this idea of three branches of government, and the president wasn't above the Congress or vice versa. So he didn't want to be seen as a king, and he sent that in writing, and And that really started a tradition that lasted until the 20th century.
Early in the 20th century, right. But, and to your point, vice versa. I mean, he was clear that he was not a king, nor were the members of the Democratic body to supersede the republic as a whole. And so and it's important that we remember that we are a republic. So anyway, I think it's great that you're having this conversation, but hopefully we will remain a union.
I'm hopeful for that. But before you go, Scott, I appreciate the quick history lesson. And certainly as the show unfolds this evening, we're going to get into more of the history of the State of the Union address. But what kind of topics would you raise? In other words, and I'm not trying to make it a partisan issue, but I mean, how would you summarize the State of the Union, and what issues do you see that would be highlighting the state of our union and also a warning in terms of the State of the Union?
Well, you know, I was having a conversation with someone the other day about the whole Eisenhower warning of a military industrial complex sort of idea. But we really have watched in the last 30 years the development of a bureaucratic industrial complex. And we have to be very careful of that. We watched during the shutdown, and everybody felt for the folks who were individually impacted by the failure of paychecks to go out and that sort of stuff during the government shutdown. But it does raise the question of the size of our government and the size of the bureaucracy and, how many people we need to be making these decisions for us. The Better Together thing is going to probably raise that here locally in a big way, because for those of us, and I'm included in this, I live in an unincorporated part of St. Louis County, and I live in an unincorporated part of St. Louis County for a reason. So we've got a lot of decisions to make, and they're decisions that are oftentimes, sometimes we reach impasses. I hope we remain a union, though, for sure.
Great, Scott. Hey, thank you for calling in this evening.
Good night.
Good night, sir. And so I appreciate hearing from Scott. And if you've got some thoughts as well as to what you think the State of the Union is, what would you highlight? How would you characterize the benefits of the State of the Union? What would you characterize as the highlights? Where are we strong? Where are we prosperous? Where are we working well? And then also, if you're going to talk about the State of the Union, you're going to have to talk about what's wrong. You know, if you go to your annual physical, it's almost like the state of your body speech, okay? If you go to your doctor, and your doctor is going to tell you, hey, look, you're doing some things good. You're on the treadmill, you've stopped smoking, you're taking your high blood pressure medicine, whatever it might be. But then he's going to say, hey, look, there's some problems here. You need to drop a few pounds. You need to do this, you need to do that. You need to stop eating so much meat, maybe add in some more fruits and vegetables, whatever it might be. But that's what the State of the Union is supposed to be. Now, certainly, in the modern era, it's really just become nothing more than a glorified campaign speech. But that's one of the reasons why I wanted to kind of get into a little bit of the history of the State of the Union address, because to me, it's fascinating. I love history. And that was one of the cool things about going to law school, was that really law school was a glorified history lesson, because the laws of our country and the way that our Constitution was written and amended really reflects the issues of the day. So there's a doctrine, there's a legal doctrine called Hayden's Rule, and that is that if you look to interpret a statute, you have to look at the issue that the statute was designed to address in order to understand how to apply the statute or law. So if you look at the law, you get to see the history of what happened and why laws needed to be drafted to address issues. And so the Constitution obviously is the same. So I wanted to look at a little bit about the State of the Union address, because for so many of us, history begins on the date we're born, and we don't really understand the historical context of things that occur. But if you look in the Constitution, that's exactly where the State of the Union address is referenced. Now, it's not really called that, but in Article 3, Section 3 of the U.S., actually Article 2, Section 3, of the U.S. Constitution, it states that the president, quote, shall from time to time give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. So that's what the Constitution says. So from that one sentence, we have developed over two centuries various traditions that we assess and assign to the State of the Union. Now, I looked up the National Archives because obviously George Washington, first president, How did he fulfill this requirement? How did he do this? And so as I looked and researched George Washington, he addressed the Congress in the Senate chamber of the Federal Hall in New York City, because Washington, D.C. really wasn't anything then. It certainly wasn't the capital when George Washington was president. The capital was in New York. But Thomas Jefferson, our third president, as we discussed with Scott just a few moments ago, he chose to give his annual message to Congress in writing rather than make the walk down to the Capitol to actually, you know, talk to congressmen and women, because who would really want to do that? So that kicked off the tradition of sending the State of the Union address in writing. So from Thomas Jefferson until 1913, the State of the Union address was done in writing. So when Abraham Lincoln gave the State of the Union address, or Jackson gave the State of the Union address, or Calvin Coolidge, that was a little bit later. But when any of those presidents gave the State of the Union address, they did it in writing. Now, from our media frenzied perspective, that seems archaic. That you would send, because today, if you ask one of my daughters how to do the State of the Union address, you know, they would say send it on Instagram. So that's what they would say. But even in writing, it seems rather archaic to have to send it in writing. But in 1913, Woodrow Wilson, at that point, I guess he wanted to buck the trend, and he went back to giving an address to the Capitol. Now, here's what's fascinating about this. Think about this. 1913, Woodrow Wilson. You're in the era around World War I. The country is in difficult times at this point financially. And what does he do? He wants to go to Capitol Hill to give a speech about tariffs. Now, whom have you heard talk about tariffs recently? We've heard President Trump talk about tariffs. We're in this tariff war right now with China. And it's interesting how history repeats itself. But President Wilson was the first president since John Adams to talk to the Congress directly on their own turf. So President Wilson goes and he gives his State of the Union address. And from that point forward, 1913, we have the modern incarnation of the State of the Union address, which is given directly to Congress. And we've actually got to see a spat here this week that I don't think has ever happened in the history of our country, where the Speaker of the House denied access to the President to Congress for a State of the Union address. So keep in mind, the President had several options. He could have written the speech. He could have mailed it into Congress. He could have written, he could have tweeted it to Congress. That would have fulfilled the requirements of the Constitution. We all know President Trump likes to tweet. He could have done that. Or he could have done what I wanted him to do, which was go on the road, go to the people, do a campaign-style rally, and give the State of the Union, except give it to the people. And that would have been, I thought, a way to overcome Nancy Pelosi's objection to him speaking directly to Congress. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk a little bit more about the State of the Union address. But again, I'd like to hear your thoughts. If you were giving the State of the Union address, what would you say? What would you highlight? What would you point out as being positive? What would you say is negative about the state of our union? Brad Young sitting in on Camo X, 314-436-7900. We'll be right back.
Local news from St. Louis's news, traffic, and weather station, KMOX.
Welcome back to Camo X. Brad Young at your service. Glad you're with us this evening on Camo X 1120. And we're talking about the State of the Union address, the history of it, and the fact that it didn't happen tonight, but it will happen next Tuesday, so you won't be able to hide from it. But talking about the history of the State of the Union address, I find it very interesting that President Wilson in 1913, he was a very progressive Democrat, if you look at his policies. And he believed, though, that a nation would benefit by a more, I don't know, active, presidential-looking president working alongside Congress, but also kind of working with them in the legislative lawmaking process. So that's why he wanted to deliver his message directly to Congress. Again, he was the first one that had done it in person in front of the both chambers of Congress. But think about it. So we only think about presidential imaging so much because of the television era. I mean, we always think about how, if you look at the election in 1960, when President Kennedy was running against Nixon, and they had that debate, and you're familiar with that. And in that debate, for those who were there at the debate, it was clear that Kennedy won the debate. But to those who listened to it on the radio, they thought that Nixon had won the debate. And that was the power of presence that was there when, for those who were in person or those who actually watched it on television. So we kind of think sometimes that this idea of imaging only started in the television era, but that's not true, because Wilson wanted to have the image of someone who was actually a president that was directing the legislative process. And so if you want to look at it historically, this was really one of the first examples of where the president tried to assert that the executive branch was the most important branch. Certainly constitutionally, that's not the case. Three equal branches of government, the legislative, executive, judicial. But President Wilson wanted to have the image of directing and controlling the legislative process. And so he looked at the Constitution. He looked at Article 2 of Section 3 of the Constitution, and he thought, hey, here's my hook. Here is my opportunity to actually go in front of the Congress personally, swing a big stick, and show them how, listen, I'm going to drive this process. And so I find it fascinating that he looked to the Constitution and found, you know, this meaningless provision about informing the Congress of the State of the Union, and used that to assert what he wanted to assert, which was the primal nature of the presidency over the legislature. And since Wilson, I looked into this earlier today, it appears that every president except Herbert Hoover chose to go before Congress to deliver their annual messages. Now, I don't know why Herbert Hoover chose not to do it. I know historically he wasn't the best speaker. He wasn't necessarily the most attractive guy around. So maybe he felt self-conscious, don't know. But he chose not to do it. But every other president since Wilson has, you know, asserted that idea that, yeah, we're the equal branch of government, but we're going to try to direct and control the legislative process. And so it's interesting that when you fast forward from 1913 to President Trump's address last year, 48 million people watched President Trump's address. That's a lot of folks. And I'm wondering, for next week's speech, I wonder if the viewership will go up. Will it go down? I mean, if you look at polling data right now, people are sick of the political process. They don't like the fighting. They don't like the acrimony. They don't like the idea that people get chased out of restaurants, or that people get accosted if you go out in public. The public is really kind of soured on that. So I don't know how this is going to happen next week. Also, there's another issue as far as the presidential State of the Union address next week. The question becomes, will the Democrats even sit through the speech? I've been reading this week rumors that they're going to get up and walk out, make a big production out of leaving, or some such stunt like that. And so it's going to be fun. Pop the popcorn, wake the neighbors, call the kids. It's going to be something interesting to watch, to see how this plays out next week. Now, talking about watching, one of the things that I've always found interesting and fascinating about the State of the Union address is the idea of the Supreme Court. Because think about this for just a moment. The Supreme Court is supposed to be above the political process. They're not elected. They don't have to run for re-election. They have an appointment for life. We all know how they tend to be categorized: conservative, liberal, whatever. But they're supposed to be above the process. And yet, they always sit in at the State of the Union address. Now, I've had someone ask me before, is that required? No, it's not required at all. There's nothing in the Constitution that requires the Supreme Court to sit in on the State of the Union address. But they do. And that is a modern trend that has started, but it's not required in any way. But here's what I always think is interesting. They come in and they're always wearing their black robes, and they always try to look like, you know, like they smelled something that didn't smell very good. You know, they always try to have that sour look on their face when they walk in, because they don't want to look too happy, because it might be perceived that they're supporting one party or the other, supporting the president, supporting the Speaker of the House. So they come in very stoic, and they try not to emote any emotion. and they sit down. But they're not required to stay there. And certainly for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she found oftentimes the State of the Union address was a good opportunity to take a nap. If you go to YouTube and put in Ginsburg sleeping, you're going to see lots of video, folks, of her sleeping during State of the Union addresses. And I'm not talking about President Trump. I'm talking about even through President Obama and others. So it wasn't necessarily a political thing. I just think she thought that might be a good opportunity to catch up on her sleep. But they're highlighting this idea that there's no requirement for the Supreme Court to actually show up at the State of the Union address. I was looking at this today. Justice Scalia, he'd passed away in 2016. He stopped going to the State of the Union address in 1997. And here's what he said. He said, because it was a childish spectacle. And so he stopped going, and that seems very much like Justice Scalia. Justice Clarence Thomas also regularly skips the event, and I checked with Justice Samuel Alito. He hasn't attended since 2010. Now, you remember, I don't know if you remember this, but in 2010, it was the State of the Union address, and President Obama was addressing and criticizing the Supreme Court for their decision, and there was a controversial case called Citizens United. And Citizens United was a case that stood for the prospect that, or the principle rather, that people have a right to give money to campaigns because it's an extension of freedom of speech. Because at that point in time, the Democrats were against money because they had the perception that the big money was going to pay for campaigns, and that gave an unfair advantage to Republicans. Not true, but that was the perception. So because of that, President Obama didn't like the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, and so he openly criticized the Supreme Court while they were sitting there at the State of the Union address. And it's interesting because you couldn't really hear it because he wasn't mic'd, but it was Justice Alito who said, not true, I think that's what he said, not true, at the point in time when the president was saying that the decision was wrong and it was going to harm America and that it did not support freedom of speech. So after that, Alito was out. So he hasn't been to a State of the Union address since then. But it's interesting that it's not just historically, it's not just the fact that the president shows up and gives a speech. There's a lot more pomp and circumstance and history to the entire process. So, for example, the Speaker of the House sends a written invitation to appear before the two houses of Congress. Now, we saw the reverse of that this year for the first time in history, where Nancy Pelosi not only didn't give a written invitation, but specifically sent a letter to the president stating you cannot speak to both houses of Congress. And I find it fascinating that if you look at the progression of tweets from the president, I don't know that he understood that Nancy Pelosi had the power to state, you can't come and address us. I think he thought, I'm the president, it's the State of the Union address, I get to give it no matter where I want to give it, and you can't stop me. And yet, I'm sure that someone sat him down and said, Mr. President, you can't do that. If Nancy Pelosi wants to keep you out of the House, she can do that because the House is under her jurisdiction. So, historically and traditionally, the Speaker of the House would send this invitation to the president. And then, I know we've all seen these images over the years, that after traveling by motorcade from the White House to the Capitol, the president enters and there's always a big rush of people. And then, as we played at the beginning of the show this evening, the person in charge, the sergeant of arms who's in charge of the House, then yells out, Mr. Speaker, or in this instance will be Mrs. Speaker, the President of the United States. And then the place goes crazy, and then they all walk in and start shaking hands, and then the further pageantry begins. But the president can't technically enter the chamber until he or she is announced. And so that's the kind of history, and I said pageantry, and that's really what it is. And to me, it's a fascinating example of how our country has evolved, in this instance, due to media, has evolved to have something that was rather a mundane, two-sentence, throwaway requirement under Article 2 of the Constitution, and has turned into this magnificent tradition-filled experience that we all have seen our entire lives. Unless you were around in the 1950s and 40s before it was televised, which many of you may have been, I was not, but if many of you may have been, it wasn't televised then, and yet now we expect it. Every year we're going to see this, and it's something that some folks look forward to, that some people dread. But here's what's interesting. At the end of at least all of the modern speeches, State of the Union speeches by presidents, each and every time, you can expect the president to close with this familiar line: the state of the union is strong. And that's what they typically end with. The state of the union is strong. What, when we come back from this break, again, I want to hear from you. Is the state of our union strong? Is it not? I would like your opinion on that subject. KMOX, the phone lines are open at 314-436-7900. Don't go away.
When news breaks out, KMOX breaks in. St. Louis's news, traffic, and weather. Depend on it.
Welcome back to Camel X. Brad Young at your service, talking about the State of the Union address. And I asked you to call in and give me your ideas of what you would highlight, what you would talk about in a State of the Union address. Gary's been holding a while, and I appreciate you holding, Gary. What's on your mind this evening?
Yes, Brad, good to talk to you tonight. Yes, Gary. I was calling to say a couple of things. One thing, I think the president could emphasize the fact that, biblically speaking, there are no mention of races in the Bible. He talks, God talks about nations, and there is only one race, the human race. And we could dispel all this nonsense about, the left using this race card all the time, in just emphasizing that we stand as members of the human race. And then another thing I would like to mention too is that he could also get us back on course with the proper direction of our government, in suggesting that every month the Congress and even nationwide population and school children would be invited to study a part of the Constitution according to the documents of the Founding Fathers. And I've thought about this for a few years, Brad. I've got an acronym for this proposal. Do you want to hear it?
I do. I do. I can't wait to hear it.
Okay. The first part would be called the CAUSE, that's CAUSE, standing for Constitutional Authority and Understanding Sovereignty Erudition Act. That's the Erudition Act.
The CAUSE. Have you, Gary, did you ever work for NASA?
No.
Okay. Because, how about this? Did you ever work for the military? Because those folks have the most amazing people to come up with acronyms. And and so that's an excellent one.
Yeah, and the final emphasis at the end of that proposal would be what I would call the clear notice, and that would be like a super duper letter you could send your congressman with official, indicating was part of this Erudition Act, and it would be called the clear notice, standing for Constitutional Legal Error Action Reprimand Notice.
You stayed up all night thinking that one up, didn't you, Gary?
Well, that's good. It's been on my mind for about a few years.
That's good.
I think we need to emphasize the fact that the Constitution is what keeps us on course, as a government.
Jokes aside, I'm teasing you a little bit here, Gary, but no, you're exactly right, is that the Constitution really isn't taught much. And I'm just shocked by that. I have three daughters, and two of which have gone through high school and college, and I've got one left in high school. And I'm just amazed at how little the Constitution is taught in our schools. And it's just baffling to me, because I don't really see it. And I want to get your perspective on this, Gary. I don't really see it as a conservative or a liberal perspective, because certainly there's been many members of the media who have criticized it, and myself included. I've even done it here this evening, criticized President Trump about his lack of understanding of constitutional principles. I'm a conservative, but I do point out when the president doesn't seem to understand simple constitutional concepts. And so liberals don't have any problem pointing that out. But in academia, we don't study the Constitution. Why do you think that is?
In academia?
which is our schools, our high schools, our colleges. Why isn't there more of an emphasis on, and I'm not saying it has to be studied like one studies the Bible, but there's not even really a basic understanding of constitutional principles that comes from high school or college classes in many instances. And why is that from your perspective?
I think that, you know, as we've seen discussed on other programs throughout the day, that there is a little regard for these people who are elected to, you know, maintain and abide by their oath of office, you know, to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Right.
And I think their disregard of the importance of these founding documents, you know, often saying these are some old dusty files, you know, that don't really have any relevance today. I think this would be exciting, though, to have the whole country studying the Constitution one day a month. It could be divided up into, you know, a couple of 4-hour times or maybe 3 times, you know. You wouldn't be compelled to all do it at the same time during the day, but I think just getting everybody on the same page and saying, look what a wonderful freedom document, you know, our Constitution and Declaration of Independence is. And I think it would be exciting and really a challenge for the school children to take a look, you know, at the Constitution one day a month. And, you know, we're always saying we need to study the Constitution more. And I think this would be a great way for the president to say, hey, let's do it. Let's quit talking about it. Let's do it, you know?
Well, if the president did it, though, Gary, I mean, in all honesty, the president's taken a lot of heat for issues with the Constitution. And so I think that the president, it would be funny if he would say, this is important for our country, and in fact, I'm going to be the one to spearhead the study or make some joke out of it that, you know, I feel so passionately about this, I'm going to be a part of it.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, I think his defense of American freedom and American independence is part of what I admire about him. He resists the globalist effort to get us entangled in these foreign commitments and these trade treaties, which, you know, eventually going to be directed toward an expanded government like the North American Union. And the thing of it is that if America is to be America, it's got to remain independent. You know, doesn't have to be. In fact, President Obama actually got before the United Nations there before he went out of office and actually said that America is going to have to give up some of its sovereignty.
Yeah, I heard that, Gary, and, you know, that was very troubling to me. But, hey, we've got other folks that are holding, and so I'm going to let you go. But, Gary, thanks for calling in this evening.
Hey, have a great day.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Camo X. Gene, you've had to hold for a while. How are you doing this evening, Gene?
Okay. Well, Brad, I heard you mention that why the Constitution is not taught in the schools. Remember, the school board dictates subjects that are taught in our schools because a lot of the things that was taught when you were going to school, they no longer teach that. I'm going to name something else, cursive writing. They don't teach cursive writing.
Yep.
In
school and you know what else they don't teach, Gene, is spelling. There is no emphasis on spelling. And I've had this conversation with my daughters many times because now the assumption is anything that you do, you're going to have a spell checker on it. So why do you need to know how to spell? So I find that to be deficient on so many levels. But why do you think that applies to the Constitution? I mean, why? I understand your point that is that the school boards and the districts make that decision. But the question is, why do they make that decision?
Well, I guess they feel as though that's not important. Remember how people put things in order? They say this is important, it's not important. But I think the Constitution is very important for some people. You might not learn it all, but you should learn some parts of the Constitution so that if someone is speaking, making a statement, and it's not true, you can always have a rebuttal and let them know you can find this in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Also about
good for you,
power,
Jean.
I have one more statement. One thing about the power in the United States. The United States will always be a strong nation because nobody all these years cannot overthrow the United States government. And if we continue to let these people come in, the immigrants, one day they will try to overthrow the government. I hope the Democrats take that under consideration.
Great. Jean, thank you for calling in this evening.
Okay, bye-bye.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye. One thing where I would differ with Jean on it, I don't have any problem with immigration. None at all. In fact, our country was built by immigrants. And one of the things you've heard Charlie Brennan say many times, we need immigrants and now more than ever. But what we don't need is illegal immigration because we have no ability to control the flow of folks coming into our country. If you're getting into Six Flags, they control the flow, okay, because they want to make sure that you get in a certain time, the rides aren't overloaded. I mean, even something as simple as Six Flags, they got to control the flow of folks coming in. Brad Young with you this evening in lieu of the State of the Union address. We've got lots more in the next hour. So thanks for being with us, and don't go away.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.